Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while creepy crawly science slithers into your brain. I'm Victoria Bond. On this edition, we'll feature cockroaches, crabs, and kindness. But first up, here's the news with Larissa Sevens and Julianne Popple.
Are you the sort of person often targeted and approached by senile, funny, weird, clingy, evil types? And you wonder why you are selected over seemingly similar individuals? Well, perhaps the scientists at Oregon State University have the answer for you. Researchers here recently found that people with a particular gene trait are known to be more kind and caring than those without it, and strangers can swiftly spot the difference. The variation is associated with the body's receptor gene for oxytocin, often touted as the love hormone, due to the fact that it often manifests during sex, as well as promoting bonding, empathy, and other social behaviours. Researchers concocted an experiment in which 23 couples were filmed, such that one member of the couple was asked to recount to the other a time of suffering in their life. Observers, oblivious to the genotypes of the couples, then watched the listener for 20 seconds without the sound. Participants were tested prior to the study and found to possess GG, AG, or AA genotypes for the DNA sequence of the oxytocin receptor gene. It is those with two copies of the G allele who are generally judged to be more empathetic, trusting, and loving. On the other hand, it is those with AG or AA genotypes who are generally judged to be least trustworthy and admit to feeling less positive overall, in addition to feeling less parental sensitivity. In the majority of cases, observers in this study were able to successfully determine which listeners possessed the kindness gene. Whilst these findings suggest that even a minor genetic variation may be rapidly perceived by others, and hence have a real impact on people's behaviour, no gene trait can exclusively predict an individual's behaviour.
Joining me in the studio today are Ian Wolfe, Patrick Ruby, and the lovely Julianne Popple, talking about the love hormone, which I can feel is in great supply this evening. So Patrick, you were mentioning a few instances in which oxytocin manifests itself.
Yes, well, this is stretching my memory a little bit, Victoria, but going back to thinking of what we know about oxytocin, is oxytocin is the hormone that's typically associated with lactation. So once a woman's given birth and it's time to feed the baby, when you're producing milk, it's oxytocin, which is the hormone that actually helps to stimulate the milk to come out.
And it's also quite involved in the actual labour process. So I think as a woman's uterus is contracting, she's releasing oxytocin. So not, you know, she's in tremendous amounts of pain, but then there's this lovely love drug that washes it all away once the baby's there and forms a bond.
Isn't it also something that they give to women in labour if they need a little help, is they give them some oxytocin?
That's right, you can induce a woman with oxytocin.
So it's very interesting stuff. And the fact that people can tell a genetic difference by watching behaviour is amazing.
It makes me wonder if these empathetic people have been selected for throughout evolution. If you can tell, you know, who cares, I guess, about your well-being and your sorrows, would that be a positive selection, do you think?
It sounds like it would be a positive selection. I mean, there's a positive and a negative, right? Because on the one hand, they care more. On the other hand, if you don't have that gene, then you care less. And you can tell. So does that make that person an easier sucker?
I don't think that would be a huge contribution to selection, because when you think about it, it's like, is that going to make a difference to whether they contribute to the next generation or not? If you're slightly less caring, maybe you're still going to find someone who doesn't care quite as much as you do or cares the same amount and they're still willing to produce babies and produce more oxytocin when they lactate further down the track?
I can think of a couple of instances where it might not be an advantage on a social level. When you're the only one at a party and you're stuck with a person no one wants to talk to and you don't really want to talk to them either. You want to get out of there, but you're too nice to actually say, sorry, I've got to be somewhere else. And maybe this oxytocin might not be the biggest advantage.
The curse of niceness.
The curse of the curse of kindness.
Humans, we have an underlying sense where we can pick up whether strangers will be kind to us or not. Crabs, on the other hand, they can't really sense this so much, but they can remember past behaviours of other creatures in their environment. And then from this, they're able to ascertain whether a novel creature will be a threat or not.
Okay, and so this was a study that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, right?
Yeah.
And what did they look at?
They did a study where they had an object approach the crabs, and it was found that after about 5 approaches, the crabs were able to realise that the object was not a threat to them anymore. However, when they changed the direction from which the object approached, the crabs then retreated.
Okay, and that was perceived as a threat in that case.
Yes.
Yeah, so this is acclimation, where you get used to something that's like a sound in the background, like maybe an air conditioner or something, that you just get used to it because it's there all the time and you know it's not a threat. But in this case, if it comes from a different direction, then it's no longer safe.
So it's full out of left field.
Exactly.
Habituation, in fact.
Habituation, yes.
Is it true, or you'll have to tell me whether this is true or not, or you, hopefully you'll know, or is it just an urban myth, that when crabs get stressed, they start blowing bubbles? I'd heard that myth from somewhere.
We need to ask a crab bubble expert, I'm afraid.
That's true. I've seen them blowing bubbles.
I've seen them blowing bubbles too. It could be like the squids and the ink.
But that could be true, actually, because when you go to Yumcha and you go to these Chinese restaurants, you see those crabs blowing bubbles in their tanks, or just before they're going to be
and
killed.
What crab would not be stressed if it was living in the middle of Yumcha?
Yumcha restaurant.
And then they're extremely stressed.
Don't pick me, don't pick me.
I've just got this image of a crab with a little hoop with a little circle on the end of it blowing bubbles out in the middle of a restaurant. As a way of reducing stress.
Just to pass the time.
And apparently these were European green crabs that have invaded North America several times. And so they're worried about them because they eat them.
I feel like I still don't understand why this was worthy of publication. I feel like that's kind of a standard response. You know, like things come out of me from unexpected places and I still jump.
Well, I think it's interesting from the perspective of how, like, something that's of limited intelligence perceives something that's dangerous or not. And it's just interesting on the pure level of biology and how animals learn and how they behave. So it's a warrant as much as any other behavioural study.
It's one of those things where crabs' vision is really poor. So they're just seeing blobs. So the fact that they can tell the difference between a dangerous blob and a not-so-dangerous blob enough to actually survive is pretty impressive, and so how they do it is quite interesting. But of course, this is science, so I mean, on the one level, there's biologists going, look, this is what these crabs are doing, here's a fact, and what we do with it later on is up to us, but usually it turns out to be useful. We might be able to program computers, or there might be things we can do with this information. It's hard to know.
Yeah, just like, you know, looking at insect behaviour, for an example, which is very similar to a crab's. You know, there's roboticians making all sorts of advances learning about how to program their robots based on insect behaviour. So all sorts of surprising applications can spring from it. But on a fundamental evolutionary perspective, I find it fascinating nonetheless.
I feel as though I should apologise for that crabby remark of mine.
You're listening to Diffusion Science Radio. Diffusion at 2scr.com. Brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network, into Sydney on 2SER, and over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com.
So let's move on to happier things. Patrick, you have a story about evolution and promiscuity, which seems to be the topic of this evening.
Well, it might be, but I'm not sure if it's a happier thing. Apparently, promiscuity might not be as good an evolutionary development as we may have been led to believe. Now, this research comes from ABC Science Online. It was conducted by Dr. Jane Reed and Rebecca Sardell of the University of Aberdeen, looking at song sparrows, comparing song sparrows from sparrows that were promiscuous, in other words, sparrows that actually had multiple partners, as opposed to sparrows that were in a more monogamous relationship, and then saw what the implication on their offspring were. And it appears that sparrows that are in sort of more promiscuous or relationships with multiple different sparrows, I suppose, or end up having offspring which are less fit for survival than those that come from monogamous pairings. So 2% reduction in overall survival for the offspring from a sparrow which has had several different partner sparrows. We're not exactly sure why this is, but it's an interesting development because it sort of flies in the face of one theory of reproductive drive, which is that there's an advantage in having many partners because it means that you're able to spread your genes out more.
So sparrow spouses would be preferable because the previous theory of evolution was that, as I understood it when I studied evolution, it was more for the males of certain species because they invest a lot less in their seed.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas females of most species invest quite a lot into these very nutrient-rich eggs that they can't produce as often, males can produce, you know, heaps and heaps and heaps of spermatozoa or whatever the species happens to use. So I understood that the theory was more that for males, it's better to be promiscuous evolutionarily because you can just spread your seed and it doesn't cost you anything, right? But for females, it's better to be more in a monogamous relationship evolutionarily because you're having that stability and that partnership that helps raise the child and protect the child and bring nutrients, etc. So I think it's an interesting study because they didn't go into that gender breakdown that oftentimes crops up in evolutionary science when it comes to monogamy and polyamory and, you know.
Well, the odd thing is they're using something called quantitative genetics to determine how fit the chicks are. Does anyone know about quantitative genetics?
Because
interestingly, ABC's website that has that story, one of its related stories is polygamy produces more virile offspring.
There you go.
Seems like a bit of a contradiction. According to Wikipedia, quantitative genetics is the study of continuous traits such as height or weight and their underlying mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extension of simple Mendelian inheritance in that the combined effects of one or more genes in the environments which they expressed give rise to continuous distributions of phenotypic values.
So what it basically boils down to is that what they were looking at, the little sparrows ended up stunted or thin. And that could possibly be just an offshoot of the fact that they didn't have possibly stable parent sparrows to raise them.
By 2%.
And it's, I mean, that's a huge inference. It could be all sorts of other things. That's so just me applying.
It could be more, in that way, it's more of an environmental thing than a strictly genetic determinant. Is that kind of what we think might be causing this 2% or at least contributing to this 2% reduction in fit?
Well, I mean, they've got all these unanswered questions and they're saying, okay, if promiscuity does have this 2% cost, if you go off and have chicks with some other bird, then you end up with less good children. If that's the truth, then why would you do it? Because that's expensive. You want to have healthy chicks.
But what if you have more chicks? That could be better. It doesn't matter if, you know, you could have 3 very healthy chicks or 12, you know, pretty healthy chicks. That's still better in the long run.
Depends on how well they survive.
Well, this is the thing. If they're 2% worse, then they can't compete as well against the chicks who are 100% good. And so evolution would kind of select against them.
But, maybe. I mean, if it's a really rich environment, then it wouldn't. If there's not a strong selective process, then it is better in the long run, possibly, to be promiscuous and have lots of offspring, because they don't really have to compete because there's enough to go around. But I think it's when times get hard.
One of the things the authors talked about as a way of justifying how inbreeding, how promiscuity developed evolutionary, is that it may have helped to avoid inbreeding, whereby if you are more promiscuous, then you may have this 2% reduction in general fitness of your offspring, but you also avoid the perils of perhaps inbreeding, whereby if you're mating with someone whose genes are too similar to yours anyway, then those offspring are going to be really, really unfit in the long run.
I think that's a very good point. I think there's a lot of things that this study can look at in future studies. I mean, like a breakdown between genders, and also looking at the fitness of these offspring in very highly selective situations and in less highly selective situations. I think that would change everything. And our last news item is Julianne catching us up with the latest Spidey news.
It was reported on news.com.au that scientists from Australia and the National University of Singapore had discovered that golden orb weaver spiders use an alkaloid chemical in order to deter ants from crawling on their webs. Now, why would such fearsome predators be bothered by a few little pesky ants crawling on their webs, you say? Well, apparently, Professor Mark Elgar said that spiders are actually vulnerable to attack from gang groups of ants, and the chemical may serve to not only protect them from these attacks, but also to conserve the spider's energy that might otherwise be spent by chasing these pesky invaders away. The chemical may also be useful in the future development of pesticides.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking about cats again.
You're listening to Diffusion Science Radio. Send us emails to diffusion@2ser.com. Diffusion is recorded in the 2SER studios in Sydney and brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network. And you can podcast us on our website, www.diffusionradio.com.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.
Next up, I intercepted New Scientist writer Wendy Zuckman at Sydney's short story gathering, Penguin Plays Rough, the science edition. She read me the following story.
On a midnight foray into my kitchen, I flicked on the light and saw what had become a devil's playground. Cockroaches were fornicating on my pots and dancing on the cooker. They were grinding on my floor and scuttling around the fridge. Disgusted, I reached for the light switch. The snack I'd hoped for was no longer enticing. But then, I saw one critter climbing up the fridge. I leaned towards it to take a look. Its antennae were probing around as if looking for reception. Why? The roach looked almost Mexican. How have you come to live in my home? I pondered, before squishing it with an empty milk bottle carton and going back to bed. When I moved to Sydney from Melbourne, I was told only about the fabulous weather and harbour views. No one mentioned the rampant roaches. But my midnight encounter was just the first of many, and my question would not go away. How have you come to live in my home? Of the thousands of critters flying around Sydney and crawling on the floor, why are cockroaches one of a handful of insects that can colonise a human home? Well, while you might think that your acclimatised dwelling with endless food supplies is the perfect place for insects to find themselves, it's not so. Most beasts that find their way inside die of thirst or hunger. And plus, there's very few places to burrow eggs. Now, this is because compared to your home, or compared to the wild, your home is actually pretty dry, and most of the food is inaccessible with pincers and microscopic claws. So what are cockroaches doing right? Well, it turns out they have two tricks up their pincers. For one, they're not fussy eaters. Nathan Lowe, an entomologist at the University of Sydney, rather poetically told me, they are masters of cannibalism. They'll eat everything. They'll even eat themselves. Now, it turns out, they'll even eat us. Sailors on ships to colonise new worlds were oft reported waking up to find hungry roaches nibbling at their calloused feet. It's thought the bugs had a penchant for dead skin because there was less of a chance they would wake up their human meals. But eating anything isn't all that special or unique. It turns out that there's a second trick that is rather clever. Unlike humans, dogs, cats, and almost every species on the planet, cockroaches don't get rid of their excess nitrogen. Now, usually in humans, when nitrogen waste builds up, it becomes toxic, which is why we pee it out. Roaches, on the other hand, can break down these waste products into their basic parts and then refashion them into essential amino acids and vitamins. Now, this means they can survive with very little food and a poor diet of very little protein. Now, I know what you're all thinking. How can they do this? Well, it's actually bacteria living inside the roach's belly that deserve all the credit. Now, when you squish a roach and white goop seeps out of every cracked orifice, you're actually witnessing the bacteria, or rather the fat that house the bacteria. Now, it's these guys that can actually convert nitrogen into amino acids. Now, so intricate and close is the 140 million year old relationship between a roach and her vermin that if you kill the bacteria with antibiotics, the roaches will struggle to survive. And kill the cocky, you'll wipe out an entire colony of bacteria. Now, finally, perhaps a word in the roach's defense. Now, while they may skulk around sewers and drain pipes, cockies do not in fact carry human diseases. And unlike bedbugs, they won't give you nasty bites. Plus, contrary to the popular myth, they also wouldn't survive the radiation spewed from a nuclear apocalypse. Now, that's unlike the humble fruit fly and the parasitoid wasp, who actually just might. But perhaps that's a story for another day.
That was Wendy Zuckman, writer for The New Scientist magazine, and her story on cockroaches. And that's all from us this time on Diffusion Science Radio. Send us emails at diffusion@2ser.com. Once again, that's diffusion@2ser.com. And tell us about your thoughts, feelings, and stories. If you'd like to be on the radio and you live in Sydney, we'd love to have more volunteers on Diffusion. You can also subscribe to our podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. Once again, that's www.diffusionradio.com. And don't forget to check out our Facebook page at Diffusion Science Radio. Contributing to the program were Wendy Zuckman, Ian Wolfe, Patrick Ruby, Julianne Popple, and Larissa Savis. Diffusion has been panelled and produced by Ian Wolfe in the studios of 2SER in Sydney. I'm Victoria Bond. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Looking at the URL, the first thing that sticks out is the colon. And how about a slashing or cutting sound for the slashes? To complete the experience, we might throw in the HTTP and maybe some kind of download sound. www.diffusionradio.com. Lachlan Watmore on guitar.